And welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, and I get to be the host today of what I think is a really great program. We had the opportunity earlier in this week to record a story with Bill Albrecht. And Bill has written a book entitled Abandoned in Hell, The Fight for Vietnam's Firebase Kate. This is an enthralling, exciting, amazing story of one man's courage. He received a Silver Star for his actions there. They are attempting right now to upgrade that Silver Star to a Medal of Honor. So we're going to get to that as fast as we possibly can. But first, I want to make sure that we thank all of our sponsors. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans, U.S. Wings, VBA Post 310, Charles Kettles Post here in Ann Arbor, VFW Post 423 of Ann Arbor, and American Legion Post 46, all of Ann Arbor. We encourage you to go to our website, veteransradio.net. We want you to, you can make a donation of buddy money to the cause. And also you can check out our merchandise there in the exchange that we've got up there on our website, veteransradio.net. So sit back, relax, and I think you're going to find this story really interesting. So we'll be right back after this with Bill Albrecht. And welcome back to Veterans Radio, and this, of course, was, you just heard the anthem of the Vietnam veteran. Everybody over there knows that song. And the reason I played that is our guest today happens to be a Vietnam veteran. He's a three-time Silver Star recipient. His name is William Bill Albrecht. His book is entitled Abandoned in Hell. He co-wrote the book with Marvin Wolfe, also another Vietnam veteran. He's got a nice foreword by Joe Galloway in there, so this is an all-Vietnam story. So, Bill, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, thank you, Dale. It's a real honor to be on your show. Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, thank you very much for agreeing to be on the program on such short notice. I wanted to start off with, you know, you were in the military for quite a while, and then you were a civilian, and then you worked for the government as a Secret Service protector of presidents, and then you worked in for Ford Motor Company in security, and now you're a motivational speaker and all kinds of good things, but let's get you into the Army back at the beginning of time.
Sure. Well, I went to Holman Catholic High School in Rock Island, Illinois, which Holman Blues Brothers, I might add, yeah. Right on the Mississippi River, part of the Quad Cities area, across the river from Iowa. And I didn't have I wasn't a tremendous student or anything. I just didn't study. My biggest accomplishment in high school was playing varsity football. And after it was over, I certainly didn't have the grades for college nor the inclination. Myself and my best buddy, Joe Murphy, we joined the Army. And I'll never forget going down there to see Sergeant Curlis. And he said, what do you boys have, what's your intentions? I said, sir, we want to be airborne infantry and we want to go to Vietnam. And he looked at us like we had two heads. And he quizzed us for a bit to see and make sure that we were, he was being set up. And he goes, oh, well, this is your lucky day. I just happen to have two slots here. And boy, they'll be gone today. Yeah, you better get them now. I don't know when I'll get more. We all, Joe, we got to sign up now. So off we go. And, went up to Chicago, got inducted and left Chicago for Clarksville, Tennessee, Fort Campbell. Oh, probably about 10 to midnight, truly the last train to Clarksville.
Yeah.
Got down there, basic, and during basic, you know, they gave us bunches and bunches of tests. And it turned out I was, the nuns and priests of Allman High School were correct. I was not a boy myself. And I scored very high, and I ended up taking the OCS test. They said, you're taking the OCS test. And I didn't even know OCS, officer candidate, test. It could have been OCS, could have been Oklahoma Cook School. I had no idea what it was.
I didn't even know you could go to OCS without a college degree.
Yeah, back then. And I passed. And off I go to Benning School for Boys, Fort Benning, Georgia. And I was still 18. And I graduated. Well, I turned 19, middle of August. I graduated August 31st, 1967, as a newly minted second lieutenant, and then right to jump school and became a paratrooper, and then off to Fort Bragg for a special forces officer's course. And so now I'm 19, and I am Special Forces trained and qualified. By the way, I was always the one in high school had to buy the beer because I always looked older. So my sergeant had no earthly idea how old I was. And like every good second lieutenant, I went and volunteered for Vietnam duty. And don't you know, they sent me to Thailand. They sent me to Thailand to train the Royal Thai Army for a year. Now my time was up, and it was 1969, and I had fulfilled my 2 years commission time. But yet I hadn't done what I set out to do, and that was to go to Vietnam and pick up the fight from there. And I knew that I would be going there taking somebody else's position, but I was so much better trained than anybody, than the average guy going there. So I felt compelled, and I felt this was my duty. Plus, there was an overwhelming sense of adventure ahead of me. I'd been trained and trained and trained, and now, by God, I'm going to be able to put everything to use. And I certainly did that.
Well, just tell me a little bit about the training that you did receive as an officer. And I don't think that most enlisted people understand the additional training that you had to go through.
Well, I just came out of 6 months OCS, which was highly, highly physical and intense, and basic infantry tactics, advanced infantry tactics, et cetera, et cetera. When I got into Special Forces, it was a whole different bailiwick completely. We were trained in unconventional warfare, guerrilla warfare, and I tell you what, it was very, very physically demanding. True, absolutely true. However, I'm 19. I just spent 7 months, 10 months, 12 months in nothing but training. So I was in top physical condition when I got there. But what took me more of a surprise was the intellectual aspect of it. These were extremely hard tests that they were given. And you had to study, you had to learn, you had to crack the books. And, I mean, it was a tough go. There was a lot of college guys in there. There was a doctor or two that were going through because they were going to be signed as the medical officers. And everybody found it not to be a staff. But I got to tell you one thing. So I was kind of in the middle of the herd scholastically, or maybe to the lower part of the herd scholastically. But tactically is where I really came into my own. But I want to tell you a story about one of the individuals there. He was brilliant, and he maxed out pretty much all the scores and all the testing, and he ruined the curve for the rest of us. But he was a good guy. When he went to the field, he, you know, proverbial, couldn't find his both hands in a flashlight. One of these guys, he just couldn't get it right. So when it got down to almost the last day, he was pulled out of class. We never saw him again. Then he went down the road to the 82nd Airborne, and I'm sure he did a great job there. But you had to have the combination of both. You had to have your field craft and your knowledge to go forward with Special Forces as an officer and certainly as enlisted.
Well, I know that it was a tough go, because many of the Special Forces people that we got to work with, you know, were extremely talented, and again, they knew what they were doing. One of the things about being a helicopter pilot, and you touched upon this in the book, and this for all you rotor heads out there, this is a great book to read just to give you some memories about your training and what your job was in Vietnam, is that, you know, we were super specialists. We never really knew where we were going or why we were going. I'll put it that way. We always knew where we were going. We just never knew exactly why, because we were on a need-to-know basis. And so we would take teams like yours, you and, you know, four or five indigenous people out into the middle of Cambodia and drop you off. But we never knew what your mission was over there. And I suppose that's not necessary for us to know that. So we're kind of an early Uber or Lyft driver, I think.
What did Galloway call you, goddamn lunatic?
Yeah. I love that line.
My Lord.
We are talking with Bill Albrecht here on Veterans Radio. His book is entitled Abandoned in Hell. He's also, there's a documentary out there called Escape from Firebase Kate, which we'll get to in a little bit. All right, so now you've left Thailand. You're in Vietnam in 1969, correct?
Correct, August. I arrived in country, turned 21, and at the end of the month, I was promoted to captain. So, the younger Special Forces captain, certainly the youngest captain of the elite troops, I would say arguably, but no one has ever been able to countermand that. So, yeah, I was, 21 by a couple, by less than 2 weeks or so. And here I am, captain. And again, I always looked older, so it was never a problem for me, never actually a problem. So I was, got there unassigned, even though I volunteered for Special Forces and I was supposed to be there. When you get the camera on, as everybody will remember, they kind of looked at you and shuffled you wherever the need was. But I went and pled my case to this major, and he assigned me to Special Forces, and I went up there. And initially, when you got there, you all went to Hontray Island for a two-week indoctrination course. It was a good little course. Got you really indoctrinated you as far as Special Forces, their mission, and what was going. And then I came back, and they said, "Where do you want to go if you have a preference?" I said, "Yeah, I want to go to the two corps mobile strike force, the two corps Mike force. That the Mike force. I want to take a moment and talk about that."
That's okay. Go ahead. Yeah.
They had four battalions and a recon company up in two corps, based out of Plaku area. And I think maybe one in Bamatua. They were all battalions that were made up at full TONE, 400 miles in the arts, and they were all paratroopers. All of them were paratroopers. They were extremely well motivated. They were highly paid, and they were extremely well trained. Some would say mercenary. I would not. I would say they were fighting for their cause, which was not necessarily the Vietnamese cause, but they were fighting for their own rights, their own freedoms. Mm-hmm. And the Mountaineers, or the indigenous tribesmen of Vietnam, would be very much equivalent to our American Indians. So the men that led that, a team of 12 Americans would be assigned to a battalion, and they were all special ops. Every one of them had special ops. So this is where I wanted to go, because the Mike force was a reactive force throughout two corps, which was by far the largest corps. And when an A team got in trouble, the first call went up to the Mike force, and they would always insert into most of the time it's a hot area, sometimes even hot LZs, which is, as you well know, what that's like.
Yes, and you guys always seem to attract lead.
They hear us coming. Now, whose fault is that? No, I'm just kidding. They said, "No, absolutely not. You have no combat experience. My force is all second tour guys. The first tour guys have already, you know, got their chops and are assigned there. So if you want action, we'll send you to Bupang," which was down on the Cambodian border in southern Tu Khor in the Central Highlands, which was, it was just gorgeous down there. It truly was. I went to Bupang, and I was the junior captain, and there was a senior captain there, Captain Palmer, and he was a CO, and I was his XO, which is a little unusual asset, even as the first lieutenant job. This was a big camp, a really, really big camp. And so I took up my duties. And about, right towards the end of October, like the 27th, 26th, 27th, the colonel came out from the B team from Bambi to it, and I was in charge of giving him an intelligence briefing, and I gave the intelligence briefing and all the signs. Of course, we didn't have the sophistication that they have now, but all the signs were pointing to a massive invasion. The monsoons were over. The dry season was upon us. A big invasion from the north, coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and Bupang was right in the middle of any movement they would make to Bambi to it, which was a provincial capital. And so I gave this briefing and then everything, and I got done, and he goes, "Great briefing, Captain. Oh, by the way, you are taking Captain Barnett's place at Firebase Kate. You're going to run the security. There's about 130 mountain yards there, plus another 30 Americans with three artillery pieces, and you're going to be out there for a month." I said, "But, sir, Colonel, they need me here. We're getting ready for this offensive, and I'm working with the yards who were buttressing up our defenses, blah, blah, blah." And he goes, "Be on that helicopter tomorrow morning." "Yes, sir, I will be there."
Right.
So I arrived in the afternoon of 28 October 1969 at Firebase Gate.
Well, I think I can kind of put some of this in perspective for other people that were over there in October of 69 is when we had some really interesting times as well, just a little bit south of where you were, in a place called Budop and Quan Loi, which was another branch of the Ho Chi Minh Highway. And there was a whole lot of activity going on, and there was something big was being planned. And when I was reading your book, The Book of the Abandoned in Hell, folks, this is a great story for you to read. I started connecting some of the dots. And I'm going, oh, this is why we were assigned to do this or that, and why they were reinforcing many of the little fire bases that were in northwestern Three Corps. So evidently, intelligence knew things were going on, but most of us didn't.
Yeah, it was a hot time, for sure. People think, 10 of 68, oh, my God, yes. So my brother, Bob, I forgot to mention, mm-hmm. God rest his soul, he was in Special Forces, Two Corps, prior to me getting there. One of the reasons I didn't get assigned to Vietnam right off the bat, but he was there for tech. Mm-hmm. That was all through an extremely busy time. Plus, you had so many other things going on. It did not slack in 69 and 70. It just kept up. A lot of people don't realize it, but I know you do, and I do, and anybody that was there fully realizes it. After landing on Kate, it was about 3 in the afternoon, actually, and Danny Pirelli was a buck sergeant, and he was from one of the other A-teams in Southern 2 Corps. And he came up to me and reported, and I said, hey, you know, how's things here? What's the situation like? And first thing I noticed is that the people were playing volleyball. They were playing cards. They were playing out, tuning themselves, and there was nothing going on, and they were taking full advantage of it. Now, I'm not against any of those things if the work is done. So I said, what's our situation here? He goes, best we take a walk about, take a look at the perimeter. So we did.
How big was LZ Kate?
I'm going to guess around 80 meters. By probably 60 or 40, or somewhere between, let's just call it 50 meters by 80 meters, maybe even 100 meters, was the perimeter. It was just as if somebody came out from the jungle hill, took a bulldozer, scraped it off, mm-hmm. said, okay, this is a fire base. It was not a good place. There was high ground around us, and you could be on the high ground around us and look right down on the camp, through the camp, or into the camp, or the fire base, I should say. Not my first selection, but, you know, hey, here we were.
Right.
So we walked around, and the defensive positions were pretty bad. The fighting positions were digging out. There was no overhead cover. The concertina was overgrown with ways. There wasn't enough claymores. It just went on and on. So Danny, you know, he had just gotten there the day before. He knew I was coming, and he decided to wait until I got there. And we could put together a plan. So had a meeting with the officers and the senior enlisted. And I said, okay, here's the deal. No more volleyball, no more cards, and none of this until we get this place battle worthy. And that includes the parapets that you dug in for your guns and so on. And I had, you know, okay, now we get this hard-ass captains in here and where things were good or not so good anymore. I had the same meeting with the mound yards. And they have their own command structure. They had their company commander and through an interpreter, and a lot of them spoke English, same thing. And they nodded, they understood. And now the sun is getting low in the sky. I figured, well, that's as much as we can do today. Because when it got dark out there, there's no ambient light whatsoever. It got dark. Danny and I, yeah. You know, kind of turned in and figured, well, we'll wait. We'll, that's the other thing. I said, Danny was the last patrol ran. He goes, the most I could figure out, what I've been able to glean from these guys, is they go out hunting. The yards go out hunting for game, and they call that patrolling. Well, as you and I both know, that's not patrolling.
Right.
I said, tomorrow morning, let's take about 20 guys. Let's travel light, heavily armed, and let's just go see what we got out there around us. Let's do some patrolling. Turned in that night, felt pretty good.
Then...
Yeah, 11:30.
Every time it gets dark over there, things happen.
Isn't that the truth? We had, Kate was the primary was, well, it was north to south. South had dense steep hill around it. And the north had more of a gentle slope that ran down to the north. And jungle came all around it because there was just a natural field of about knee-high grass all around Cape until you got to the bottom of the hill, and it turned into incredibly dense jungle. And that was, like I said, about knee-high, thigh-high in some places. And then it went to the bottom of the slope from Cape to the north, gentle slope only to the north. The jungle came around, and there was a natural gap about big enough to drive a deuce and a half through. And that led you up to another hill, very similar, but that had foliation on top of it. We lovingly called that Ambush Hill because it was a great avenue of approach. Every night we put out a ambush, you know, like four or five guys as a listening post. And what had happened at 11:30 is they engaged. And we heard all the shooting and firing going on. And, man, I am up. And this is important. I put my boots on.
Good
because,
thinking.
As you know, and has been told, if you could take your boots off at night in the jungle, in the field, that's a good night. So I put my boots on, and that's the last time I took them off. And we went out there, Danny and I, and the mountain yards came down the gentle slope from Ambush Hill through the thigh-high grass to the bottom of the hill where the jungle was in the gap, through the gap, and up the gentle slope to Firebase Cape to the grass. And that's probably another 80, 90 yards. And they got out there, Buku VC. Well, Buku French, of course, for a lot. And VC was anybody that was shooting at them. It didn't matter if they're NVA or Viet Cong. They were all VC to them. So I called Spooky. Spooky, as you know, 140, a C-47, two doors off, mini guns, and they came out and they got on station. And I worked the entire area. Danny and I did till about 3:30 in the morning. Really, really worked it over. So I felt, well, you know, we did good. Let me catch some sleep now. We'll be out tomorrow on this patrol. We'll see what, maybe we'll pick up what happened over there. And then, at the crack of dawn, I mean, it was just starting to get light. All hell broke loose. We were hit with rockets, mortars, and recoilless rifles. And remember, I told you the defensive positions weren't that good.
Right. Yeah.
We had casualties, a lot of casualties. And I'm up, and I'm calling now for fast movers, choppers, anything's going on. But first, I gotta find out where the hell this stuff is coming from. We're getting medevacs coming in, and I leave that to the artillery guys. And Danny and I strike out with about 20 armed. I mean, we had water and ammunition, and we head out to Ambush Hill. Got through the gap, went up to Ambush Hill. In the dense foliation, we looked around, and sure enough, it was the NVA. We found a pep helmet with a red star. Mm-hmm. We found blood trails. I think a broken AK-47. So we had done some damage with the with Spooky. They had been there. So we started off the north side of Ambush Hill. Yeah, through the, we were in the thigh-high grass and spaced out correctly, point. Main body, flanks, tail, and they opened up. They were in the wood line, dug in, and they opened up on us. We all hit the ground immediately, and we worked our way back to a berm, and that's when I started calling for any aircraft that were in the area. And then while in the midst of that, one of the craziest guys I've never met, a guy in a Loach helicopter came over unarmed, and no ordnance on it, no armor, no ordnance. And he started flying over. In the meantime, I dropped into the jungle, and I got the guys on the line who were going to flank the people that opened up on us, the ambush, because that's what you do. You flank them, and you roll them up. And as I'm moving to contact, he is flying over, and he's looking down at the bad guys. And he takes out his 45 and leans out the window and starts shooting at them. Now, it takes two hands to fly that thing.
Yes,
and I don't know how he's doing it with one, but at one point he actually reloaded. So how he's doing it.
He's squeezing the cyclic with his knees. I think so.
See, you would know that. I didn't, but I just knew he's nuts. And they're shooting at him. And he says, called Hawk. You know, that was that wasn't my call sign yet, but to simplify, it became my call sign. He says, I see them. I see you. I see what you're doing. You're trying to flank them. They're flanking you, and they got a hell of a lot more guys than you do.
Okay.
So I pull back to the berm, and I am now trying to get more air support. And at that time, we have an Army forward air control, a pterodactyl, arrives on the area. And he's flying over, and he says, man, he says, there's a lot of bad guys down there. And about that time, one of the yards comes up to me and says, sir, we're missing a man. So I had him fly over where we had initially had contact, and sure enough, there's a body. He said, I see a body. So myself and two of the mountain yards, so we're going to go down and get that guy. Now, you got to understand, these yards, these mountain guys, they didn't know me from anything. Mm-hmm. They didn't know anything about me. And I felt that it was important for me to go with them. So I said, hey, go get that body, bring it back here. It's important for me to go with them to show them that I value their life just as much as I value my own.
Right.
And this is what a leader does. Mm-hmm. So I said, Danny, cover us. And the M60, which we had with us, and the grenade launchers, he put it all into where we had taken fire initially coming off ambush hill. And we took off running, three of us. And sure enough, there he was laying down there. And we didn't get one round fired at us. And there he was laying there. It was a serious head wound. So I put him on my shoulder, scooped up to 2 yards, opened up, and then the NVA opened up. I think they were shocked. And then they opened up on us. But yet we got back to the berm, and we got in medical attention, and we were all together again. And we had actually rescued that guy from that physician. That's when Pterodactyl comes over and he says, you got to get out of there. He says, there's more coming, and they're going to cut you off at a gap. Oh, yeah, tell me twice. So we pulled down. Now we're heading south through the gap, back to Firebase King, and we buttoned up and let the games begin.
And the games did begin. Again, reminding our audience that we're talking with Bill Albrecht, who was a captain in the Special Forces in Vietnam in 1969, October, the end of October 1969. His book is Abandoned in Hell, and I'm sitting here, I can't hardly breathe just listening to your stories. And we know that the bad guys are coming even more. Is that right?
Yeah.
They've decided that they're going to get rid of you now.
Well, we were in their way. The camp of Bu Prang, like I said, was a substantial Special Forces camp. And it was the only thing between the Ho Chi Minh Trail, but I like your Ho Chi Minh Highway. That's actually far better descriptor. Bu Prang was the only thing between them and Bam Vi Thuot, which was a huge target. Their plan was to take Bam Vi Thuot and then continue over to the coast and cut Vietnam in half, which is one of the things they did in 75 when they actually did take the country. Mm-hmm. They came down from the north and they cut across. Well, Bu Prang had to go because they were going to use that as first. Apparently they had he had only been up front running for a little over a month. They had no recollection or no intelligence, that Kate was even there. Kate was there, and there was two other fire bases, Annie and Susan, in a triangular area around Bu Prang to lend supporting fire. And they stumbled upon us, I guess, and they decided it's got to go. You know, 100, well, at that time, we were maybe 150 guys. How tough can this be? What I didn't know, and I found out later, was there was two NVA regiments, the 28th, and the 66th. Now, the 66th is the same regiment that Hal Moore fought in 65 in the Idrang Valley, and we were soldiers once and young. And now they're back, they're refitted, and they're ready to go. They were a fine fighting unit. You can say that about your enemies, because I did respect them. And the 28th, as I said. And then they had a contingent of another part of an artillery regiment there, whatever artillery is called. They sat up across the border in a Cambodian army camp, Camp La Roland, and they didn't engage us initially, the infantry did. And they came at us with everything they had, hundreds and hundreds poured across, I should say up the slopes from the dense jungle. We had you guys. We had our gunships, and they never faltered, and they would fly in hard and fast and on fire with ordnance, rockets and miniguns, and they kept them off my arc. And then when I could get them and they were starting to stack them up, we had sorties of F-4s, the fast movers that come in. They would drop their ordnance. They would drop napalm. And because of our air superiority, the fighting spirit, and the grace of God, we held. We had some penetrations, but we were able to beat them back. And we would do that from dawn, it seemed, till dark. And then Spooky would come on station, and they were terrified of Spooky.
Well, and he would
start firing off. Yes, anybody with any sense. So that continued on for days. Now it's the 29th, the 30th, the 31st, and there's much going on, much going on. And I think it was the 31st, and I'd have to consult the book. Joker 85 came in, and they had brought in 37 millimeter, anti-aircraft with them, and they had it set up in their home. And Joker 85 came in, and they ripped him apart. And he went down, burst into flames, and Nolan Black and his entire crew were killed instantly. And it was so close to our perimeter, I could actually feel the heat of that. And from that point on, we could not have any more close helicopter support, tactical support, and rightly so. They were going to blast them out of the air. We were able to get medevacs in quickly, in and out at certain times. We had enough cover from the authorities. They'd worked their way in, but it became really hard. And when you can't get close air support with our lifeline, the helicopters, well, then supply became a real problem, and water became a real problem. And those are the only two things we really needed, was ammo and water. And we'd have to, and every pilot that flew in there, as far as I'm concerned, should have received a Distinguished Flying Cross. I don't have enough praise, because without them bringing in what we needed, we would not be here. And this kept up till November 1st, when it became really bad. And I had, that morning, I said, if you want me, by the way, this was no longer a fire base. All our tubes and everything were destroyed through direct hits, because they had it zeroed in. We had taken a lot of casualties, and we had gotten seriously wounded, and most of the dead out, all the American dead, but not all the yard dead yet. And I requested reinforcements. I said, if I'm going to hold on to this worthless piece of real estate, you're going to have to get me boots on the ground. I don't have enough people, and I'm losing them. This is my first command. I wasn't about to give it up unless I was told to.
Right.
So the word went up. You know, I mean, Vietnam, as you well remember, our whole job there was to find the bad guys, engage, and do as much destruction as we possibly could. Well, here I had them. Mm-hmm. I had them. I need help. So the word went up. And the 4th Infantry Division with 10,000 men was 100 kilometers away. The 23rd ARVN, Army of the Republic of South Vietnam, was 50 kilometers away in Bami Thuan. And they could have come. And they were going to come. They were going to send Americans in there. But Richard Nixon was putting into effect Vietnamization, where they, let's get the Vietnamese to fight this war. So we start bringing our guys home. I understand that. I understand that. So the Americans couldn't. So they said to the Vietnamese, you've got to go in there and get these guys out. And the Vietnamese looked at it and said, yeah, no, we're not going to do that.
No, maybe tomorrow.
We got to stay here and bam me too. Maybe tomorrow, maybe next day. So they said, no, we're not going to do that. They said, well, you have to. They said, nah, we don't have to. And either side blinked. So we're on our, not quite on our own yet. Special Forces said, well, by God, we'll send them the mic for us. So they had a again, nobody at this time knew how many bad guys were out there, but the estimates, considering the size of the regiments and the artillery, were 5,000 to 6,000. And now we're down to about 130 guys, but we're still holding on. So they were going to send in a reinforced battalion, the Mobile Strike Force, about 600 guys, battle hardened. And they were going to march, fight their way to us and buttress up our defenses. One thing I neglected to say, which had a pivotal role too, was about 2 days before, we're taking incoming, or the mortars and the recoilless rifles and the B-40 rockets. And all of a sudden, the earth shook. I think my very DNA shook. We were taking artillery from Cambodia. Now, this is we basically had holes in the ground that we were fighting from. Now we had overhead cover, by the way. They did a good job on that. And I called up to the forward air controller, Major Latin, what a great guy. George Patton, I should say. And I said, hey, I said, we're taking some heavy fire. He says, let me check this out. So he flies due west, and not far, didn't have to go far.
No.
And he says, it's artillery and it's coming from across the fence. And I said, well, call it an air strike. And he goes, it's from across the fence. I can't. And I'm thinking, oh my God, we'll never be able to hold through, out through this. And then he right away asked, the only way I can do that is if the ground commander, me, declares a tactical emergency. I said, I declare a tactical emergency. Roger.
And they went in there and
bombed the hell. Oh, they bombed the hell out of it. And my name was on Richard Nixon's desk within an hour of creating an international incident. By the way, it was on there twice because I did it again. So we had taken care of that problem. But now we didn't have much ammo left, and water was critical. So I'm watching through binoculars through the rolling hills and the vegetation, which was only about thigh high in many parts. I could see the mic was coming in, and I could watch them coming in. The cavalry is arriving. But as they landed, the NVA, of course, knew this. And they probably sent about 1,000 guys over to them to fight them.
Sure.
So they got about 180 guys on that LZ, and they were they came under fire. Now, as you very well know, you cannot land on a LZ in the middle of a firefight with things going back and forth. You never could get out of there. So no more could come in, and no one could get out. And the Mike Force fought valiantly. Now they were in the open. They were not dug in. And they broke off, broke contact, withdrew, reset up their lines, and the NVA pursued. They fought them again. So I'm listening to this on the radio. They were overwhelmed almost to the point of being overrun. They dropped back, set up another line, a skirmish line, if you will, and held. And the NVA pursued. Vastly outnumbered, they dropped back, but this time they kept on dropping back. And they came to me and they said, Hawk, we can't get to you. So just about that time, I realized my heart sunk. I knew that we're not going to get out of here. We can't count on anybody to get out but ourselves. And the mountain yard came to me in the bunker, in the command bunker. And I was getting ready to get some radio traffic, and they said, you know, Guy, we got to get out of this place, huh? Just like the song.
Right.
I said, I completely agree. And we're going to wait till the dark. So I put together, I coded it up, and I sent a message Now, this is November 1st. I sent a message to headquarters and said, request permission to abandon Firebase K. Now, keep in mind, I had a tremendous amount of walking wounded, percentage-wise, that is. This was no longer a Firebase. It hadn't been a Firebase. The mission had long since disappeared. I had a new mission now. My new mission was to save as many of these men as I could possibly save them. And before I actually sent that, I did have a meeting with the Yard and the Americans. And I said, gentlemen, we're in a really bad situation here. We have three options. Number one, we surrender. And that is never going to happen. Number two, we die in place. But to what end? We're not the Alamo. We're not trying to buy time for Sam Houston. There is no point to this. And number three, we attempt to break out. And I said, gentlemen, we are going to go with number three. Now, you notice I didn't say, so who's in favor of this? Oh, let's have a vote.
Not a democracy out there.
No. I consulted them all and got their feelings, but decision lies with the leadership. And I was in that position, and I made that determination. So once that was established, what we're going to do, I said, send this message to headquarters or our higher up and tell them we're request permission to abandon Firebase K. It didn't take them long. And they, in the meantime, we started, surreptitiously because they were looking right down on it.
Sure.
We started gathering up the code books to burn them, and, we're going to spike the tubes. And although they were useless, we still were going to do this. And then they came right back and they said, permission denied. I said, okay. So,
whose bright idea was that?
I have no idea.
Somebody.
Somebody that wasn't at K.
Yeah, obviously.
Well, I sent another one. I said, we are abandoning Firebase Gate tonight. And I sent it. And there was, as a leader, you have to do the right thing. You have to do what's right. And normally doing the right thing is always doing the hard thing. Mm-hmm. So we continued on, and but sometime later they came back and said, permission granted, and what we're going to do is have Spooky come out and fire in front of you. We're going to have fire in front of you, and this is the path you are to take. You are to leave Firebase Gate on the north end, which is the only way we could have gone, right? Go to Ambush Hill, break left, go around the base up to the left of Ambush Hill, and there will be a contingent of the Mike Force, like a reinforced platoon, will meet you there and then guide you back to their main body, and then you will come back and work your way back to Boot Prime. This is better than the plan that I had. So I said, absolutely. Without going into too much greater detail, that night when it got so very dark, we got everybody together. We're at the north end of the hill. Now we're down about 130 or so guys, and we're down the north end of the hill, and we're all hunkered down. We're all waiting. We're waiting for Spooky to come. Spooky's going to come to shoot in front of us, and we're going to follow that fire at a pretty good little distance and walk while he clears the way for us. Well, I'm listening on the radio, and I hear Spooky, Hawk, this is Spooky 2-3. Go ahead. Listen, we got some mechanical problems here. He said, we're going to have to go back to Fan Rang. And, well, don't worry. We got another one coming out right to you. Well, Hawk was worried. He says, oh, time is getting away from us now. The second one comes out. And they are in. And he calls Hawk, this is Spooky 2-5. Go ahead. We got some mechanical problems. We got to turn back, but don't worry. We'll get another one. Now Hawk is very worried. But as I laid there, I picked up the Brick 25 mic or the handle, and I pressed it to talk to find out where Spooky 4-1 was, the new one that's coming out. Spooky 4-1. It's Hawk. Over. No answer.
Oh.
Spooky 4-1, Hawk, over, no answer. So I turned to my RTO tech I said, this damn radio isn't working. He looked at me and he said, sir, he says, you're going to have to let go of that push the talk switch. I had depressed it. I had it in a death grip. My knuckles were white. And as soon as I let it go, they came back to me. Hey, we're here. We're still out, but we're coming. And I realized at that moment in time, I was just as scared as everybody else there. I was so scared. My gut was in my mouth. And I also realized another thing. I am going to die that night. I'm going to die tonight. And there's really no way out of it. So I looked up to the sky. I looked to the cosmos. And I came to grips with that. I said, dear Lord, the big ranger, I know it's my time. I know you're going to take me tonight. And you know what? I'm okay with that. Just please, please let me get as many of these fine young men to safety as I can. And then I'm ready to go. I'm ready to go. And at that moment, at that exact moment, a calm came over me. It's hard to describe. I was no longer afraid. I was absolutely focused in on the mission, and I knew what we had to do. It wasn't long after that they started dropping mortars on us. And I said, we can't wait for Spooky. We got to go now. And we did. And as we approached the gap, which was the perfect choke point for an ambush, my point man stopped about 30 meters short. He was terrified. And I worked my way to the front, and I was told he can't go forward. So I said, let's go. So I led them to the gap, and not only did I know I was going to die that night, now I knew where I was going to die. Mm-hmm. My God, we got through. We got through, and I'm standing in the gap, ready to lock and load. I'm a full auto. And I start pushing guys through. Let's go, let's go, let's go. And the point man, instead of going to the left as we had talked about, and I told him to link up with the mic for us, went to the right. Now I saw where he went through this moonlight now, but I said, oh, hell, we'll figure this out later. Now let's just get all these guys to the gap. And Danny Pirelli, he had the tail. I had the front, he had the tail. He was pushing them to me, and we were getting through there. And I can't say enough good things about Danny Pirelli. I can't. He was a consummate special forces trooper. And he backed everything I did, and he took charge when needed. He was a super guy. So he breaks right, and finally I catch up to him, and I'm calling to the mic force. I said, I'm putting everybody in a single file, and we're going to penetrate the jungle into your perimeter. And about that time, two things happened. One, the mic force came back and said, we're not there. We couldn't get to you. You're going to have to come to us. And the second thing that happened is from the top of Ambush Hill, the NVA opened up with a 51 caliber tripod mounted machine gun. And all hell broke loose. What had happened is they had heard us, and they were set up on the left side of the hill, but we went to the right. How did that happen? I prefer to think it was the hand of God. Took that point man, put him to the right instead of the left. If we were in left, we would not have had this, we would not be in this conversation now. So we went to the right, and we were low off the slope of Ambush Hill, and it was rather steep. And when he opened up with that 51 caliber, he couldn't get it low enough to rake us. And so it was firing about a foot off our head, above our heads, which was enough. And of course we returned fire because now we're in an ambush. And in the meantime, I'm screaming, cease fire, because I thought it was initially Spooky. I thought they were shooting at us because it was coming from above. And then when I got my senses about me, I saw they were green tracers, ours are red. And then we continued into the jungle, and it was chaos. There was a lot of shouting. There was a lot of putting, this is in the middle of a firefight. But I got everybody back together, and we proceeded now through the jungle, and deadly quiet and deadly slow, but we had to put distance between us and the NBA, and we moved quickly and silently and then slowly once we broke, we put some distance between us.
Wow.
And it was hours.
But luckily, through the hand of God in this case, you did. You were able to do that, and unfortunately, we are running out of time here. And I could listen to this story probably for many, many hours, but this is a really, it is an amazing story of survival. And I want to thank you, Bill, very much for being on the program. The book is Abandoned in Hell. It's co-written by Marvin Wolf. It's a story of the fight for Vietnam's Firebase Kate. I got to have you back on the program at some time in the future so we can talk not only about the end of the book, but also to talk about the documentary on the escape from Firebase Kate. Much, much more to know, and I want to thank you very much for your time.
Well, it truly was my honor, and if anybody can get anything out of this, then all the better. And I can't thank enough the pilots and the helicopters and the fast movers. Without them, we would have never, ever made it. So thank you very much for having me on, and I hope this reaches enough people and they get the message.
I don't think they will, too. Thank you very much, Bill. Appreciate it very much. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. Take care, Dale.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, we're going to take a quick break here, and then we come back. We've got another story about Bill Albrecht that is kind of interesting, I think. Some of his awards, there's an attempt to upgrade them. So we are talking now with Ken Moffitt. He's the legislative aide to Senator Neil Anderson of the Illinois 36th District. And somehow he got involved in this story with Bill Albrecht and Firebase Kate. So tell me what it is that you're up to.
Well, currently I'm working on trying to upgrade Captain Albrecht's Silver Star that he was awarded, his third Silver Star, actually, for his leadership role at Firebase Kate. I first got involved in this case back in 2010 when I worked as the congressional aide for then Illinois Congressman Bobby Schilling. It came across my desk, and as a Vietnam veteran, I saw this and I was just absolutely mesmerized by the heroism that I saw in this. And as I reached out to other participants, the men that were at Firebase Kate, and they spoke of Captain Albrecht's heroism, selfless heroism, it was just, I had to do something about it. So I got deeply involved in this and went to Congressman Schilling and several other congressional offices, and they all concurred that this action, in their opinion, rose to the level of the Medal of Honor.
But you've been running into some roadblocks. What's been going on?
Well, the Department of the Army, for some reason, doesn't see it quite the way that we do. They don't see it quite the way that several high-ranking former government officials, including lieutenant generals from the Army. Interestingly enough, the major general who presented Bill with his Silver Star, the third Silver Star for his actions at Kate, asked me after the briefing of why we're doing this, and I told him the story, and he said, "Why is this not a Medal of Honor ceremony?" And I said, "Sir, that's what we have been trying to figure out. And we're not getting any clear answers from the Army." Now, I do have to say that the Army does not owe us an explanation. I know this. But for something as significant as a battle that took place for 5 days, and quite literally, according to some of the senior officers that were involved in setting this whole thing up in 1969, it kind of redirected the war, because the North Vietnamese were not allowed to take that last Firebase Kate that they needed. Then they would have moved to the Special Forces camp at Bu Prang. They would have been at full strength. They would have taken Bu Prang. Their ultimate goal was to go north, capture Banh Mi Thuot, the provincial capital, cut South Vietnam in half, thereby forcing the Saigon government to capitulate or form a sort of a bilateral government, if you will, with the North Vietnamese controlling the northern half of South Vietnam, and the South Vietnamese, if they were lucky, would have controlled the southern half of Vietnam. The interesting thing about this, Dale, is that in 1975, this is exactly the plan that the North Vietnamese used. They went north, cut South Vietnam in half, and we know the rest of the story.
Right, absolutely. So what can we do to help out? I know locally here in Ann Arbor, we've got some people that are very interested in doing this because we had upgrade a Distinguished Service Medal to a Medal of Honor for Colonel Kettles here in Ann Arbor. And so what can we do? Is there some petitions we can sign, contact Congress people? What do we need to do?
Well, here's what where we are, and then I'll let you know what I think we can do. I've currently been in touch with Senator Joni Ernst's office from Iowa, where Bill Albrecht lives, and she is looking into finding out why the Medal of Honor was downgraded to the Silver Star, even after the Army Review Board recommended the upgrade from the Silver Star and that it be upgraded to the Medal of Honor, or at least they reconvene a Medal of Honor Review Board. Now, the interesting thing about that, in their document that they sent to the Army, they said that they did not want the first team that had looked at all of the paperwork that we had sent up in 2010, they did not want them looking at this again, which tells me that they recognized the error, that mm-hmm. this should not have been the Silver Star, as their document said, that they said, quote, "The Silver Star that Captain Albrecht was awarded for his actions at Firebase Kate are inadequate. Upgrade this award." Mm-hmm. The Army has refused that. So I've reached out to Senator Ernst's office in Iowa. She is looking into it. And I have actually asked their people at her office. I said, I'd like a bulldog on this. I don't want a paper pusher. Paper pushers get nothing done. I want somebody that's going to follow up on this. I've also reached out to the office of Congressman Michael Waltz of Florida. Congressman Waltz is a lieutenant colonel, retired lieutenant colonel, special forces. So he understands what we're going through, what Bill went through specifically. I've been working with one of his team members, a retired Navy captain by the name of Randy Stapleford, and he's been a very, very valuable help. And he's guiding me through the process. He's worked with the State Department and so on and so forth, and he's done this sort of thing. But what I'd like to see is if we cannot get a lot of public interest in this case to find out why an individual who is credited with saving 150 lives, 27 American and 132 mountain yards from certain death after being wounded, refusing to be medevac, stayed to lead these men, and he still denied the honor that he should have been awarded back in 2010. I want to get as much public attention to this as possible. If I can get the news media, the national news media, I don't care who it is, I want them to see this for what it is. These are true heroics that Captain Albrecht and the rest of the men at Firebase Kate should be recognized for, not just blown off on the ash heap of history.
Right. Absolutely. We want to make sure that doesn't happen, people changing history like that. I want you, please, Ken, keep me informed about what's going on, and we'll do what we can here to publicize this and see if we can get the word out and maybe get some people that are actively involved as possible and get Bill his due. And I know he's a very humble man, just like all the Medal of Honor recipients I've ever met. They are just that way. And it's not about him. It's about all those people that he was able to save. And so I want to thank you very much for giving me the time, or giving us the time here on Veterans Radio. And so we'll push this for you.
Dale, I appreciate you bringing it to the forefront. And if there's anybody out there listening that knows somebody or they themselves can help with this, please feel free to give Dale a call, email, write, however you contact him. He's got all my contact information, and hopefully we can get this over the goal line.
We will do that. Thank you very much, Ken Moffitt, trying to upgrade three Silver Stars to just one Medal of Honor for William Bill Albrecht. Thank you very much, Ken.
Thank you, Dale.
All right. Another program here at Veterans Radio. We want to thank you all for listening. And we're going to go out on a song by Michael J. Martin. It talks about the last firebase. How appropriate, right?
So we want to make sure that you're tuning in next week. And this is Dale Thronberry. Until then, you are dismissed.
Coming to the last fire base, I've been across the country, Lord knows how many days, all those nights and all those images of faces of the ones that were left behind. Yes, we're coming to the last fire base, back along those trails I have retraced in my dreams. I can't bear to believe it was just wasted, like it had only happened in my mind. And I'm torn between the need to remember and the reasons that I tried to forget. I've been drawn to a day in November by the feeling that it ain't over yet. It ain't over yet. There's a sentry at the last fire base. He'll stand his lonesome vigil night and day. His eyes strain through the darkness as the rain beats on his face. And he knows it's gonna be a long, long night. And he knows this is the last fire base. The sleep nags at his consciousness, his weary body aches. The pain pulls at his soul, 'cause he knows he'll have to wait till there's an answer to all the questions in his mind. And he's torn between the need to remember and the reasons that he tried to forget. He's been drawn to a day in November by the feeling that it ain't over yet. It ain't over yet. Here we are at the last fire base. We'll stand here at the wall, our backs are braced. We're not gonna have our history erased anymore. No, we're not just gonna forget that it happened this time.
What'd you say?
I said we're not just gonna forget that it happened this time.
I don't think so.
I said we're not just gonna forget that it happened this time.
Let me see if I believe it.
I said we're not just gonna forget that it happened this time.
You gonna let it go away?
I said we're not just gonna forget that it happened this time.
Stand up, stick your fist in there.
I said we're not just gonna forget that it happened this time.
America, listen to us.
I said we're not just gonna forget that it happened this time.
Let me hear you say it.
I said we're not just gonna forget that it happened this time.
A song about the statue that faces the wall. Three guys that represent us, black, white, red, brown, coming out of the tree line, looking at 58,000 names on the wall. It's come down to the three of us.